Okay, I'm excited to introduce Caroline to you. She is amazing. Y'all are going to be super blessed today. I'm going to read this bio, but this bio is just very dry, and it does not encompass who Caroline is. It just doesn't. She's a dear friend. I love her dearly. But I'm going to read this for you because I want you to know what you're getting today. Caroline Newman graduated from the University of Mississippi with a BA in psychology. She later attended Reformed Theological Seminary and received her master's in marriage and family therapy and counseling. After living in Malawi, Africa, teaching college-level counseling courses and providing mental health services, she returned to the States and earned her PsyD at Rosemead School of Psychology in La Mirada, California, however you say it. Okay. She then completed her pre-doctoral internship at the University of Northern Colorado with a focus on eating disorders and her post-doctoral fellowship at EdCare. Following her training, Caroline served as a primary therapist for 5 years at EdCare and is now the regional clinical director. Caroline is a licensed psychologist in the state of Colorado. Outside of work, she enjoys traveling and also loves community, especially her church community, and having people into her home. That's those good old Southern roots, you know, that we all have. Just love having people over. And so I'm really pleased to introduce her to you. So thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. It's really, really fun to be back at RTS. It's fun to be back in the South and just kind of soak it all in. Literally, I'm soaking in the humidity. My skin is very glad to be here. Colorado is very dry, much like my bio. but really, really good to be here. I will say, I always say this and claim it, 10, 12 years later, Mike, however long we've been out of school, that even with my post-master's training, RTS to this day remains the core of my education and the core just of my professional being and identity. So if you are a current student, soak it in while it's here. Drink from the fire hydrant, as John Damon used to say, professor during my years. If you are a post-grad, always come back to these sort of things. If you are contemplating coming to RTS, come, do it. If you are a spouse, I'm first sorry. And a spouse of a current student, I'm first sorry, and then thank you. But if you're just a community member coming, then great. But just wanted to speak to the value of RTS and the MFTC program, MAC program. Sorry, they've changed. Yeah, okay. They've changed some letters since I've been since I've been around. Let me get this going. Okay. So Mike Hillerman reminded me that last year's conference, y'all had Kurt Thompson, and I'm glad I didn't remember that until I got here, because I may not have come, meaning want this to be fruitful for you all, and please don't expect Kurt Thompson level here today, but still very, very glad to be here. Eating disorders are my passion, treating them. I was talking with my parents this last couple of days, and they said, Caroline, why did you get into it? And following in my father's footsteps, I said, well, I heard that eating disorders were the most complex and the most difficult diagnosis to treat, which is why my dad went into cardiology, because it's the most complex and the most difficult medical ailment to treat, so to speak. And I said, I wanted to do that, because it's really, really difficult and equally as rewarding. So I love the irony in that. So we will jump in. I think the break is at 10:15. I did not bring my agenda. Am I have their agenda? 10, thank you. Okay, so I will watch the clock. So we're gonna cover a smorgasbord of eating disorder topics in terms of etiology, treatment, diagnosis, presentation, empirically based theories that treat eating disorders, wide range. I think the most beneficial is when there are questions, so please feel free to raise your hand. I'll monitor the time, but please feel free to raise your hand. There will be a Q&A at the end if you're not really sure where your question fits in, so feel free to wait or jump in and raise your hand. Okay, can y'all hear me okay in the back? We're good? Okay, let's go. So, take a look at Emily. Read through some of these details and just kind of speak to what jumps out at you. No right or wrong here, but speak to what jumps out at you about this case study. IBW's ideal body weight.
She's alone. She lives alone.
Lives alone. What else jumps out at you?
She's dealt with her parents divorcing and her parents. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of change in her life.
Yeah. So a lot of change in her life, parents divorcing and remarrying. Okay. No right or wrong here. Just looking at some of these descriptions. We'll come back to it at the end, but just kind of keep Emily in mind. Okay. Here we go. Eating disorders are common. Okay. Between 3.3 and 1% of young women have anorexia nervosa. Bulimia nervosa, we'll go through what each of these diagnoses is, as I know that there's likely a range of experience with eating disorders, knowledge, that sort of thing in the room. We'll go through what each one is. Around 1 to 3% of women have bulimia nervosa. Around 3% of the population has binge eating disorder. Between 4 and 20% of young women practice unhealthy patterns of dieting, purging, and binging. So that's up, and that's 2 out of 10, okay? Can get up to 2 out of 10 have some sort of what we would call disordered eating behavior, practice. Currently, about 1 in 20 young women in the community has an eating disorder. Few more statistics. 25% of American men, 45% of American women are on a diet any given day. I have a whole nother separate slide that I didn't include in here that has the diet fads listed back to, I think I started in the 60s and really couldn't make the font any smaller to fit on one slide, so I just kind of stopped, because in 2019 there's like 4 more. So it's prevalent. Dieting culture is prevalent. Americans spend over $40 billion on diet and weight loss products per year. This is a big one. 95% of all dieters will gain the weight back in 1 to 5 years. 95%. That's almost everyone. Maybe the most important on this slide, dieting is the gateway behavior to eating disorders. Caveat, does dieting cause eating disorders? No. Is it a gateway? Is it a appetizer, if you will? Yes. Okay. Other things cause eating disorders that we will talk about. Dieting being a proponent or a catalyst. to eating disorders. First and third grade girls, very much exposed to the idea of thinness. 8 to 12 year old girls have already begun to use some of these, what I'm going to call behaviors, eating disorder behaviors, acts of eating disorder symptoms. And then on a, I'm not sure what college campus that was, but among a sample of, well, likely several college campuses, a sample of 2,800 undergraduate students, 13.5% of women, 3.5% of men screened positively for at-risk behavior. Any thoughts on why there's such a discrepancy between women and men in terms of percentage? Yeah. So it's that males are significantly underreported. Not that they don't have or experience or present with, demonstrate, exhibit eating disorder behaviors. It's that it's not culturally acceptable. It is becoming more culturally acceptable to disclose, admit, go to treatment for eating disorder behaviors if you are a male identifying patient, client. But it's not common. And so there's all, hopefully we're narrowing the discrepancy. However, for many, many years and decades, there's been quite a large discrepancy between male and female. And that's represented in treatment centers. It's likely represented in your outpatient practices. If you have any eating disorder clients in your practice, there's likely way more females than there are males, or no males. This is something that we will come back to many, many times. It just points to the complexity of eating disorders, that there are many factors involved when you look at the presence, prevalence, treatment of eating disorders. It's not just medical. It's not just biological. It's not just psychological. It's all of these aspects. And we'll break that down for sure. I think this is a really helpful continuum to think about if you are just beginning to be interested in eating disorders. Honestly, if you have no interest in eating disorders, that's fine too. But if you are going to come in contact with individuals that have some sort of eating disorder symptomatology, this is a helpful continuum because it takes you from kind of everyday, normal, non-clinical issues all the way to diagnosis of eating disorders. So on the far left, we have normal, natural eating. So you eat in response to hunger cues. You feel satiated. You stop eating when you feel satiated. There is no such thing as a good or bad food, okay? You're accepting of your own body size and shape, accepting of others' body size and shape. There's not this, pathological or significantly distorted relationship with food, okay? So that's normal, natural eating. Natural being, I listen to my body and what it needs. And we have the dieting culture, okay? So starting to get into the disordered, potentially restrictive, potentially hyper-focused area. Calorie counting, cutting, in terms of cutting out food groups that you might deem or your patients might deem good and bad, skipping meals, types of food. This is where good and bad foods comes into the vocabulary of your clients and patients, and maybe following a diet regimen, okay? So a dieting culture. Then we go to a subclinical eating disorder, okay? So the occasional more significant eating disorder behavior, okay? Binging, purging, can be different forms of purging. I'll talk about that in a minute. Binging, purging, taking diet pills, a heightened preoccupation with body size, shape, weight, okay? To the point that it's starting to occupy your thinking, your mind, your time, more so than not, okay? Some loss of control around food, whether you're overregulated around food or you're underregulated around food. So some loss of control. There's no longer that flexibility. When I say your, I mean your in terms of all of those that we might care for. I'm used to talking to patients and clinicians, so my apology if I kind of interchange that. And then we've got clinical eating disorder, okay? So anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and there's the group of otherwise specified feeding and eating disorders that we'll get into in terms of the DSM-5. Very helpful continuum. Think about it in terms of diagnosis. Could be very helpful. You may have seen this before. I understand that y'all just went over this in psychopathology yesterday, so sorry for the repeat, current students, in terms of diagnosis, but still important to look at. So anorexia nervosa, probably the more commonly talked about, heard, familiar diagnosis within our culture, okay? Significantly low body weight by restricting energy food intake. Okay, an intense fear of gaining weight, significantly intense fear of gaining weight. Distorted body image, extreme focus on shape and weight. Denial of serious illness, that's a huge one, and I'll explain how it manifests. Literally, there's a biological thing that happens in our brains that causes this level of denial, okay, in an anorexic patient. And then most common age of onset is in the teens, specifically 12 to 25, okay. What happens in teens from 12 to 25?
Puberty.
Sorry?
Puberty.
Yes, sorry, good, yeah. Everything, literally, anything and everything that happens in a person's physical body, their psychological well-being, their relational well-being, their identity, literally everything is within 13-year span. Bless you, parents. I have a 5-month-old. I'm not looking forward to 12 to 25. And everything happens. So no wonder the age of onset is teens, specifically 12 to 25, okay? Such formative years. Yes, also childhood, and 12 to 25 is when that starts to really manifest. Two types of anorexia nervosa, the restricting type, which you're probably most familiar with, and then there's the purging type, okay? So you can have all of those restrictive behaviors, fear of gaining weight, denial, and engage in purging type behaviors. Very, very, very serious, the anorexic nervosa purging type. So this is, when I talk about denial, this is a representation of denial. So I'll explain it. You probably have to look at your sheet for those of you in the back. So here we have an fMRI of 4 different brains, okay? And there's 4 different descriptions on each one. Top left corner is an anorexic woman looking at other people, okay? Looking out at other people. Top right is a normal woman, meaning non-clinical, non-diagnosed woman, looking at others, okay? Bottom left is a normal woman looking at themselves, so their reflection. And then bottom right is an anorexic woman looking at themselves, okay? What's the main thing that's glaring at you about these differences? The red region is the visual cortex. That might have been helpful for you to know. What's the glaring thing that's different among the 4? There's one that really stands out. There is nothing going on in the visual cortex of an anorexic woman looking at herself. Therefore, there is nothing that's being activated that is representative of her taking in what she looks like, particularly her body image. Okay? So many times I have patients that sit across from me, just happened 2 weeks ago, 52-year-old medical professional, MD, anorexic, alcoholic, practicing for 20 plus years, looking at me, and I'm telling her, you've got weight to restore, you're not making good decisions, that kind of trying to tell her the reality of her illness. And she just said, I don't see it. I don't believe you. I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm this size and I'm that's too big. I've got to be this size and da 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 da. And I'm looking at this starved mentally and physically woman, a medical professional who treats people, well, was treating people. And she said, I don't see it. If I saw an fMRI of her brain, it would look like that bottom right, because there's nothing visually being activated because her brain is starved. And you can be someone of normal size and weight and you're malnourished. Okay? It doesn't just have to happen in an anorexic brain. This happens to be an anorexic fMRI, and someone's brain can be just as malnourished and they're of average weight and size. Okay? Very, very important when you've got someone, you're working with an anorexia, and they are in full denial. Expect them to be in full denial until they become nourished again. Okay? It's frustrating and it's real. Bulimia nervosa. Recurrent binge eating, okay? An objectively large amount of food in a short amount of time, okay? A sense of feeling out of control. And then you've got these compensatory behaviors, okay? So consistent efforts to undo the binge is what I call a compensatory behavior. There's an undoing. Compensatory behaviors can be via vomiting, laxative abuse, excessive exercise, and then this one gets a little confusing, but fasting or excessive significant restriction. And you've got to get in with a fine-tooth comb in terms of this diagnosis, because it could present as anorexia nervosa, but that's when you look at, okay, their weight, their BMI. That's when you look at why they're restricting, because you can have the binge and then do the fasting, restricting, but it's to undo the binge. Okay, so that's what categorizes it into bulimia. And then still that extreme focus on shape and weight. And then the frequency criteria as behaviors both occur on average at least one time a week for 3 months. I think an important thing to note about bulimia nervosa is that many times it's called the hidden disease, because anorexia nervosa is easier to see. It just is. It's more obvious. And so many times bulimia nervosa can go undiagnosed, and it's just not as visible, which then causes kind of a whole series of questions surrounding, am I sick enough? Okay? Am I gonna get maybe the attention or the love or the care or the comfort that I'm seeking? I don't know how to ask for, so I have this eating disorder, especially if it's not to be seen. Okay, do I have to be significantly underweight in order to be seen, cared for, loved, cherished, valued? These are all questions that might play into the eating disorder. So just know that the diagnosis of bulimia is often called the hidden disease. Okay. Binge eating disorder. Recurrent binge eating episodes characterized by large amounts of food. So you've got the binge, and then these three or more criteria that play along with the binge. Eating alone, eating much faster than normal, eating until uncomfortably full, large amounts of food when not feeling physically hungry, the feeling of disgust, depression, and or guilt. And when I say binge, I mean two whole pizzas. I mean a whole box of cookies, crackers, literally inordinate amounts of food, 10,000 calories up to, okay? Definitely at least like 2,000 calories, an extra meal's worth, but significant amounts of food, okay? And then we have OSFED, to condense otherwise specified feeding and eating disorders, OSFED. These are a list of other eating disorders that do not necessarily have their own entity or category. These are no less serious than anorexia, binge eating, and bulimia. These five make up 50% of eating disorders, okay? No less medically complicated, no less medically serious. These make up 50% of the patients that I see, that you will see. So please watch out for them just as much. The tricky thing is that sometimes insurance, because they're other, insurance is not as gracious or gratuitous or free or, I don't know, accommodating in covering those with this diagnosis. So we have to fight a bit harder for these individuals. Probably the most common within these are going to be the atypical anorexia nervosa. So these individuals have all of the same symptoms as anorexia nervosa, and for kind of whatever reason, their body weight is average. Okay, so potentially another hidden disease, if you can think of it in that way. I already spoke to that, 50% are atypical. No less serious. Oh, I've already talked about this. That's great. Got ahead of myself. So in the initial assessment, I wanted to throw this in there because I think it speaks to the complexity and the necessity of a comprehensive assessment and complexity of the diagnosis. So at a higher level of care, these are most of, I would probably add even a thing or two, most of the core of our initial assessment. In your practices, in your education, these are good things to review as well, okay, with your potential patients and clients. Current eating disorder symptoms, age, height, current weight. I'll say this, send them to get a physical. Send them to a PCP. Why am I blanking on PCP? Family practice. Primary care, thank you. Totally blanking. Send them for an initial physical eval, okay? Just resource that out, okay? Get to know someone in the community who's a PCP, family practitioner. Resource that out and get a physical. You want to assess length of illness? That's diagnostic, okay? Length of illness is extremely diagnostic. Huge diagnostic marker for you to know if you're going to enter into a therapeutic relationship with these individuals. Medical complications, I'll go over what some of those are, treatment history, family history, and then how ready are they, okay? Really important assessment factors. Let me flip my pages. So, some warning signs, and I will give this caveat that some of these are more visible and more readily available to be observed in higher levels of care. And you can ask questions about these warning signs, okay? And if you're an outpatient level of care, providing that level of care, you can ask questions around these warning signs. Some they will bring to your office literally, okay? Others you're gonna have to pry for. There's excessive concern about weight and shape. That will come out verbally or not verbally, which is telling. Okay, if you're seeing one thing and they're just not talking about it, that's indicative. Okay, so just pay attention to that. unexplained or dramatic weight loss, just be observant, okay? Don't be afraid to ask. Failure to gain weight in proportion to height. This is something that typically happens in higher levels of care, so I know it may not be readily visible, disappearing to bathrooms after meals. Excessive or compulsive exercise despite whether fatigue, illness, or injury. Are they still exercising on an active current injury? Okay, that is very telling. Loss of menstrual cycle, you'll get that from your referral out to the PCP if they don't already tell you. Insomnia. Evidence of vomiting, laxative enema, or diet pill abuse. And I'll show you some ways that you can observe those signs that you can just see person to person. So ritualistic eating, do they have to eat the same time? Do they have to eat on the same plate, the same fork, drink out of the same glass, sit in the same seat when they eat? Do they have to eat in the same, so if you really want to get into it, you can ask, okay, when you've got four different foods on your plate or two different foods on your plate, do you have to eat in a certain order, a certain way? Literally, I've had patients, I have to go counterclockwise or I have to go clockwise. I have to eat all my peas and then all my potatoes. I cannot mix them. The foods they can't mix. Okay, so just that hyper focus around food. It has a deeper meaning that we'll get to. But is there some sort of ritual around the foods that they eat? Okay. They will likely know these rituals if there is a long history of treatment. If the eating disorder is a brand new idea, then you may have to explain to them what a ritual is, okay? Are there certain ways and certain details about your food that you have to have or else the meal is gone? I'm not gonna have the meal. Food group avoidance, obsessive focus on calories, carbs, fat content, food diaries, are they dictating everything that they're writing? Are they obsessive? Are they scrupulous about the food that they eat and how much? Definitely skipping meals or denying hunger cues. Just ask. How many meals are you eating? How many snacks are you eating? What are you eating? Okay. Avoiding eating in front of others. That's huge. It wasn't until after college that I fully realized how many disordered eating symptoms there were in the sorority house, honestly. And I started thinking back to, I always thought it was strange that she never sat down for a meal. Okay? Turns out she did. This one sorority sister did significantly struggle. She was a grazer. She never sat down. Or she always said, I just ate. But she didn't just eat. But she never sat down. So there was just kind of that avoidance or I just ate mentality. Withdrawal from usual friends, activities, secretive eating, or discovery that food is missing. Okay? In terms of eating disorder care, this is a continuum of care, okay? In terms of what levels of treatment, what levels of care patients can access, okay? So you have outpatient once a week, maybe outpatient group, support group. This is the lowest level of care, very effective, long-term. Of outpatient. Intensive outpatient, there's a bit of variety in terms of how many hours a day someone's IOP program could be, just to give you kind of a reference point. Our IOP at ED Care it can be up to 7 days a week, 10:15 to 3:30, so that's 6 hours, I think. Can be up to 7 days a week, down to 3 days a week for 6 hours. That's a pretty robust IOP. Most IOPs are going to be 3 days a week, 3 to 4 hours a day, sometimes 4 days a week. But it's a condensed, partial outpatient level of care. Then you have partial hospitalization. Again, our PHP is more robust than most. We really kind of operate at a residential level because we have full-time housing that we provide to our patients, so patients can come nationally who may not have housing. And so we actually kind of function at more of a residential level. But partial hospitalization could be 6 hours a day, two meals, two snacks. Ours is 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. And then they go home to our home and have 24-hour care. So it's pretty much residential. And you have an official residential, if you will, inpatient hospitalization, and then what we call acute medical, basically the ICU for eating disorder patients. This is the sickest of the sick. These are the individuals where there's, you know, the documentaries on intervention about, okay? That's these individuals that are at acute. Acute is an actual ICU medical stabilization unit at a Denver hospital in Denver. It's the only one in the country. So we interchange with them a good bit. So just kind of know those different levels of treatment. Many times you'll hear IP res, so inpatient residential, are coupled in-house together. I think this is a really helpful thing to keep in mind. It's something that I go back to within our capacity, even at PHP, and ask, are we practicing within our scope? Okay. So thinking about it from an outpatient perspective, thinking about it from a counseling center training facility perspective, am I practicing within my scope? And these are seven highlights that you can keep in mind. When to refer a patient to higher level of care. If there are weight changes of concern, okay? Maybe finding out how much weight change. A side note on that, if you send a client to a PCP, ask for a blind weight, okay? Ask for a blind weight, meaning they turn around and don't see the scale, especially if it's one of those that does the balance thing in front of you. Please have the physician, or if you have a scale in your office and you're treating eating disorders, have them turn around, okay? The number means way more than the number should mean, okay? And it's just helpful if they don't see it, okay? So just ask that of your medical consult. Rapid or persistent decline in food intake, loss of control over eating disorder behaviors. It begins to interfere with their everyday functioning, okay? They can't maintain a work schedule. They can't maintain being on time. It's just a loss of control around the eating disorder and what the eating disorder brings for them. Loss of progress with less specialized care. So if they're stagnant, much less if they're regressing, that is a good time to refer out. Co-occurring psychiatric disorders. And the reality is that no one just has an eating disorder. And in all my time in specializing in eating disorders, I've never just diagnosed an eating disorder. There's always been a slew of other diagnoses that go along with it. It's just that the eating disorder presents as primary. It's the main thing that we're focusing on so that we can get to what's underneath. So we have to interrupt the behaviors in order to get to the anxiety, in order to get to the identity questions, in order to get to a deeper attachment need. So there will always be a co-occurring. It's just whether or not the co-occurring is superseding or interfering with any sort of progress, okay? Meal supervision is required. It's a good time to usually refer out to a higher level of care. And then obviously, if there's significant medical complications that require medical stabilization. Okay. I won't go through all of these, but these are just some things of what an eating disorder might look like. So we've kind of got the warning signs, and then this is a little bit more of a caveat or a little bit more of a next step in terms of what it might look like. Again, in an outpatient setting, you would likely have to ask about a few of these, but in an IOP, PHP, you'll definitely see some of these characteristics. One thing that you will definitely see in your office is wearing heavy clothing to disguise body. Okay? There's something about remaining hidden. I often say that our patients are hiding in plain sight. Okay? Specifically those that are fearful of taking up space, the more anorexically minded individuals, they're hiding in plain sight. But they will wear just abnormally large clothing in order to appear even smaller. They will sit in chairs not intended for individuals of size. Their small, frail frame, they will sit in those chairs because there's something about feeling small and not taking up space that is reassuring, affirming to them, containing and comforting to them. So, wearing really, really heavy clothing in the summer, okay? Again, there's something in that that is likely related to eating disorder symptoms. Many times people ask about the consuming condiments, such as salt or sugar, to excess on menu items. This can be twofold. One is that in a really starved, malnourished brain, your taste buds are luxury. Okay? It's just a gift from the Lord that we have taste buds. But when your brain is starved and your body is on shutdown, your taste buds are not essential. And so many times we have patients who start to lose the ability to taste. So they will load up on salt and pepper and sugar in order to access some sort of taste to be able to eat the meal. These are pretty extreme cases. And ask your outpatients, how much salt do you use? Okay? There could be something in that. In the same way, salt could very likely be something of comfort. Okay? For a binge eating disorder, excessive salt could demonstrate comfort. So Tabasco, ask about Tabasco. So things that are extremely hot or just high temperature. We have to limit our patients' time in the microwave to 30 seconds. They would fry it in the microwave if we let them, because excessive heat will mask the taste of food. Okay? Excessive ketchup will mask the taste of food. Anything that would allow them to finish the meal because they have to, but not have to taste it. Does that make sense? So condiments can play a role that's either in line with the eating disorder, or excessive condiments can be because of the eating disorder, like because they can't taste it yet. Questions about that? Make sense? Hiding food. For the purpose of not having to eat it, we ask our patients to remove jackets and hoodies and large sweaters before they go into the dining room, because they will literally put food in their sleeves. I kid you not, after a meal, there's a trail of potato chips down our hallway because they've somehow managed to get the food in their clothing. Okay, again, higher level of care, and the behavior has a meaning to it, okay? It's there. All right. Excessive talking about food, that will be very obvious, prevalent in your practices. So comorbidity, I think it's important to keep in mind that comorbid diagnosis alongside the eating disorder, it could either be that there's an immense fear of food, maybe for trauma-related reasons, maybe for fear of gaining weight. So then someone feels anxious, and then they restrict all of their food in order to control the anxiety. That's one way. So that's how anxiety weaves in with eating disorder. Or someone has a medical condition, IBS, gluten intolerance. They fear food because of the initial medical issue. Okay, so there's a general fear of food. So they restrict food significantly. But then they feel anxious about their restriction, and so they have anxiety to go along with it. So it's the chicken or the egg, really, at some point. But you're treating all of it at the same time, okay? Depression can be in there, OCD can be in there, relational issues can be on there. But the eating disorder is either the catalyst, is the result of, is the byproduct of other co-occurring mental illnesses, okay? So I will go through these medical pieces. So before the opiate crisis, anorexia nervosa was the most, had the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder, and then the opiate crisis set in. And it still remains second, though. I don't know that I would have guessed that before I got into the field of eating disorders. I would maybe have said suicide was second or first at that time, but I wouldn't have guessed that it's that high up, and it is. So something to definitely make note of. So there is, gosh, just a plethora of medical issues and conditions associated with eating disorders. One is cardiovascular, cardiorespiratory. So you can either have significantly low heart rate or significantly high heart rate. So either bradycardia, low heart rate, or tachycardia, really high heart rate. Low heart rate's going to be like in your 40s, okay? Low in your 40s, I think that's what I said. High is going to be 120s, okay? It's pretty high of concern. Something that is unique to this is if you know a professional athlete, okay, or if you know an avid runner, they're gonna have a really low heart rate. So there is a very big difference in the athletic heart versus the starved heart. Okay? And the way that the medical community tells the difference is, if I ask someone to walk from here, I wouldn't go over there if they were significantly ill, but across the room, what their heart does when I ask them to walk across the room tells me whether or not they have an athletic heart or they have a starved heart. Because our patients come in with a 50 heart rate, 60 heart rate, 40 heart rate, we'll send them to the hospital. But if we ask them to walk just a short distance and their heart skyrockets, that's a starved heart. Okay? An athletic heart, it's going to stay at 40. My uncle's an avid runner. My father's a cardiologist. My dad always says that my uncle breaks his treadmill when he does a stress test because it stays at 40 and he's just running. And my dad's like, okay, you're fine. Because he has an athletic heart that just doesn't budge and functions just fine at like 40 to 50. It's kind of crazy. But difference between low and high. Tachycardia in the same way, it's on overdrive, okay? Hypertension, hypotension, heart attack, for the same reasons that there's a significantly low heart rate. Shortness of breath, absolutely. Sleep apnea, we send patients to sleep studies pretty often because they have some sort of respiratory issue. Likely, maybe not likely, we want to rule it out whether or not it's related to their eating disorder. These are just kind of other general medical issues. I largely took these from the Academy of Eating Disorders comprehensive list of medical issues. So syncope is fainting. So if you're sitting down for a while and you stand up really fast and you kind of get really lightheaded, that's a common occurrence. We call it syncope. And then your blood pressure drops and you faint, or you feel like you're going to faint. That's a regular occurrence for patients with eating disorders, okay? Cold extremities. If you think about it, warmth in our fingers and our toes and our hands, I mean, it's nice, but when you're in survival mode out in the wilderness, your fingers and your toes aren't vital to surviving. So all the warmth and all the energy goes to your internal organs. And so many times patients, regardless of body weight, okay, and most commonly in anorexia nervosa, they will be very cold, and their hands and their feet will be freezing, okay? Just really, really cold, because all the energy is going to their internal organs to re-nourish and refeed, okay? Weakness, fatigue. It's hard to keep someone with an eating disorder awake and alert for 10 hours of therapy a day. I think it's hard to be awake and alert for 10 hours of therapy a day, regardless if you have an eating disorder. And it's really hard when they're in the refeeding process. Loss of muscle mass, that's what the picture is. Just muscle atrophy. The body literally starts to eat itself. Your muscle's a luxury, okay? So it literally starts to eat itself. Just some other general complaints. So this is what you might actually be able to see, okay? So clients with eating disorders, you literally might be able to see this sitting across from you in your offices. There's dental erosion that happens, okay? Kind of an inverted smile, where the incisor teeth and molars are longer than the front teeth. Okay, so kind of an inverted U. It's graphic. Pre lunch, hopefully we'll forget about it by the time we get to lunch, because purging is acidic, and it literally takes away your teeth. And those with a history of bulimia, active in bulimia, you can see it in their dental work. You can see it in their teeth. Just something to note, something to see. We have patients, we have a pro bono dentist that works specifically with eating disorders in Denver, and she's done many, many implants and many, many root canals, because the erosion and the impairment and the damage to dental, your teeth, is just immeasurable. It's huge. Swollen glands, the chipmunk chinks. This is the parotid. I always forget the name of this gland. The parotid. Where am I? I'm going to go with parotid gland. I think that's wrong, but that's okay. Basically, what happens is the salivary gland inside gets really, really swollen with purging, and it expands to chipmunk cheeks. So our significant purgers come in, and they look like chipmunks. I mean, their cheeks are just so swollen until they interrupt the purging behavior, and it reduces. I have a current patient right now, and she tries to hide in plain sight because her face says everything in terms of her behaviors, and she says, "No, I'm not purging," and she's just so swollen. And she thinks that I don't see it, and I see it. So she is one where she's outed by her eating disorder. Bloodshot eyes from the purging, okay? Graphic, but true. Very, very weakened immune system. I've heard back at our clinic in Denver right now that, everybody's sick. I'm really glad I'm here. Everybody's sick. Fever's going around, flu's going around. It's just all the patients' immune systems are pretty weakened right now because they're ill. Their bodies are just not up to speed. Significant electrolyte imbalance. Constipation. So just slowing of the movement of the digestive system when you mess with a regular meal schedule. So we call it peristalsis. where literally your digestive system slows down, your metabolism stops, and you become constipated, and it is so painful. It's one of the most difficult parts of the recovery process and the refeeding process is going through that constipation. It's pretty painful. It's a little bit repeat. Maybe not necessarily that relevant for each of your practices, but still good to know. If you are in a higher level of care and you have a patient you are wanting to send to the ER, you want to recommend and lead with to not do aggressive fluid resuscitation or excessive fluids on board. Can actually really get into some cardiac issues. So if your body is really, really malnourished, extremely dehydrated, and then they're pumping the fluids, but your heart's not up to speed, it can send someone into significant cardiac shock. So whenever we send a patient to the hospital, we say, please slow the fluids, very, very small amount. Their heart is weakened, they're in the refeeding stage. So it's just one of those medical caveats that happen at a higher level of care and that are very significant. The same light, we don't aggressively refeed someone if they come in extremely malnourished. We'll start them off on a, 1,200 calorie diet, whereas some are like 24,000, 3,000 calorie diet and they're restoring weight. We'll start them off really, really small and build to a higher caloric intake. And 2 to 4 pounds a week is pretty aggressive once their body can hold that, can contain that. This is likely also something that you might see. So there's even kind of dermatological signs that can happen from an eating disorder, issues that can happen from an eating disorder. So dry skin and dehydration, kind of obvious for what it is. Lack of water, it's going to happen. Your skin's going to be dry. There's a significant hair loss and thinning. The same patient that gets really, really puffy, we were just noticing that really over time she's lost a lot of her hair. She now just has this really, really tiny ponytail, and she used to have this luscious, beautiful black hair, and now it's just dry and brittle and frayed, and that's just the long-term effects of her eating disorder. And I work with her in outpatient, and she's been in and out of treatment, and I was walking behind her into the office, and I just was like, where'd your hair go? And it's just very, very thin now. Lanugo, so that is the really soft, peach, fuzzy hair that infants actually have. Okay, so if you look at an infant, I have a 5-month-old, so I'm always looking for his lanugo. Poor thing, he's gonna hate it. So I'm always looking, and it's just that really soft peach fuzz that is on cheeks and on arms because it keeps them warm. So he's not old enough to regulate his own temperature, hence the blankets and the halves and the hats and scarves, but his lanugo helps to insulate his own body warmth. Our patients, when they become really malnourished, they redevelop lanugo, okay? They literally have the peach fuzz on their arms and right here. To help insulate and maintain, regulate their body temperature. It's fascinating. The human body is incredible. Fearfully and wonderfully made, because the body knows it's in starvation mode and will grow what it needs to in order to protect itself. Poor wound healing, just scabs, cuts, they don't heal when your body's malnourished. And then Russell sign. That's what the picture is, and that's from purging, honestly, from hand and mouth. And outpatient patients, clients will have it. They'll have scabs and calluses on their knuckles from self-induced vomiting. Okay? At all levels of care, you'll see that. So the neuro piece, eating disorder affects the brain. I call it being offline. You'll have your clients who just aren't making decisions wisely. They are not connecting the dots. They're saying, I don't see it. They're in the forest, can't see the forest for the trees, okay? You are their prefrontal lobe for them, okay? There's significant cognitive impairment. The beauty is when they become renourished and they come back online and you hear the laugh for the first time. You see the smile for the first time. They tell you of the connections that they've made and they literally start to come back online. All levels of care, it will happen because the eating disorder hijacks the brain. Or maybe it's the anxiety about the food that hijacks the brain. This offline to online thing definitely happens. I sometimes call it cave girl, cave boy brain as well. They become really, really primitive, very, very regressed. We'll never forget I think she was 25-ish. This was years ago, and she literally was right outside my office on the floor, flailing and wailing. And after many weeks, this is not usually my first line of intervention, but after many weeks of treating her, I just decided I'm not going to engage with an eating disorder brain right now because I can't. It was a lose-lose for me until she had started to restore, and I just had to contain this flailing, wailing adult. Okay, how I did that was I just stepped over her and moved on with my day. I didn't give it attention, and that eventually worked to where she could bring kind of more of her adult self. She was offline, okay, extremely regressed, kind of had that cave girl, primitive mindset, okay, and it's just a matter of time. So there's not much therapeutic intervention going on in those first few weeks when they come to that higher level of care. And outpatient, you will start to see the regression happen more and more. And they will become more and more unable to engage if there is not significant progress made, okay? So you'll just kind of start to see that happen. Increased shame and guilt, it is what it is. Self-harm, suicidality, that often accompanies kind of the more intense, more prevalent symptoms. Endocrine system, in terms of medical complications, loss of menstrual cycle, irregular cycle. This is a really hard time of when the menstrual cycle returns. It's a really hard, can be a hard time for our patients. Because the body literally needs fat in order to have a menstrual cycle. And patients know that. They probably know more medical details than we do. And when they start to refeed, they may get their menstrual cycle back. And it's a real point of real crossroads for them. Can I allow this? Can I let my body do what it's naturally intended to do? Can I relinquish that control? Can I surrender to my fear? Can I surrender to my anxiety? Can I surrender to fill in the blank? So this is a real significant place for our patients at any level of care. Because I have outpatients who have not had their menstrual cycle in years. They're functioning, but they haven't had it in years. Infertility, loss of libido, loss of bone density. We send a lot of patients to get DEXA scans to assess their level of calcium in their bones and their basically their quality of their bones. Osteoporosis in 21-year-olds, they have osteoporosis from just long-term effects of malnourishment and running and exercising on really brittle bones. impaired renal function, kidney infections, and then type 2 diabetes is very common. I'll start on this, because I know we're coming up on a break, but yeah, let's take a break. I think it's 15 minutes.